नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्सा नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्सा नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्सा बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। I was asking Tina John, how does it feel to be a monk for 40 years? And he says he's very, very grateful, and so am I. So I think both of us can say this path does work, otherwise we wouldn't be grateful. I think this is the third year I've come to Abhayagiri, and we have a tradition in our Sangha where we try to pay respect to the local elder. So my local elder is in California. And then some of you might know Ajahn Jayanto. He's trying to start a place outside Boston, so he's going to come and visit us in Canada at the end of September. So we have this very beautiful kind of family relationship in our different monasteries. And to come to Abhayagiri is a real joy for me because of the kind of, we don't use the word love much in Buddhism, but it's a very loving place. And people really look out for me, and I have a great affection for Ajahn, Tanajan Pasano. So it's always a great pleasure to be here, to be cared for, and to be in such a, I find this a very rich kind of cultural experience, because we live mostly with polar bears up where I'm from, and the edge of human habitations on this planet. And so to come here in this richness of Buddhist cultures is very inspiring for me and very uplifting. I think it's always good when we consider the teachings to remember the kind of larger context of the teaching. Sometimes we emphasize one little bit, but it's always in this large context, which, as most of you know, is called the gradual teaching. And so the texts tell us that the Buddha would lay out certain kind of principles and foundations for practice that created a whole person and a whole society. And so the teachings weren't just about an individual trying to get enlightened or work out their own stuff or something like that, but it was always in the context of a social engagement, social responsibility, and also individual responsibility. And if we were to say Buddhism 101, I think we'd say it's generosity, because that's the first thing the Buddha would lay out in the gradual teaching, that generosity is a prerequisite for true practice of Dhamma. And if you contemplate generosity, it is a loosening of self, isn't it? It's an uplifting of the mind. It's a sharing of one's life with others. And meditation, which becomes too self-referencing and too self-attainment, that loses, it doesn't really, really work, I think. Whereas when the reference is one of generosity and sharing, the heart has a certain kind of relaxed quality where investigation, discernment, samadhi, these kinds of things function more clearly. Yeah. So this is where Tanajan and I living in Thailand those years back, and now living in North America, we see the incredible generosity we do receive as monks. And Ajahn Yanako was telling me about his great Tudong experiences. In fact, I I wish he'd be giving the talk tonight and I could listen. And wonderful stories of generosity all up the coast of California. And it's interesting being a bhikkhu where we are, and we have the opportunity to express our own generosity, obviously, but also we are the recipients of tremendous generosity, and that it's a very uplifting experience, and it really impels my practice. And that, you know, it's a good one to contemplate that. In human relationships, surely one of the most beautiful things we can have in human relationships is when we can be loved and cared for by someone, but also that we can love and care for others. It's probably what we all aspire to in human relationships, isn't it? And both are necessary. You need to be recipients of love and care and generosity, and also be active in that in our own ways, in the way we give to society and take care of each other. Now, these are very, very beautiful qualities of the heart, and they have their own rewards. But that's still Buddhism 101. It's a foundation. It's a beautiful foundation. But I think we all know if it was only a matter of generosity, what do we do with old age, sickness, and death? You know, what do we do with the struggles we have in cultural situations where others are not generous, or what do we do when we get a difficult medical diagnosis? So I guess Buddhism 202 would be morality, or 201. And when we speak of morality, we're pointing to that possibility of the human heart to refrain from harming, the possibility of restraint, the possibility of pausing, just like when one has the opportunity maybe to put someone down, one pauses on right speech, and one doesn't do that. One has the, for my greatest moral dilemma now is deer flies. We live in a very wet environment, and we have we were sitting last night outside, or this morning outside in the sala. I was just amazed at how beautiful it was because there are no bugs biting me. I live in a very wet atmosphere, and I have a lot of marsh land around me, and we get a lot of bugs. So my moral dilemma is not killing deer fly. It's very hard because I hate them. Because they attack me and I take it personally. But it's an interesting exercise and restraint. And we get silly that, you know, you spread metta to the deer fly. I can't do it myself. It takes a higher being. But I can like pause, because the impulse is there. I mean, you know, as soon as a deer fly grabs, you know, sits on your head, it's trying to take your flesh away. And the impulse is certainly there. But to kind of have enough mindfulness and centeredness and to just pause, to pause, brush it away or whatever, is a skill that we try to do. And I'm being slightly facetious on that, but it's true, isn't it, that we have impulses which can be very hurtful, like speech and things like that. Impulses which not only hurt others but hurt us. So a life lived with moral impeccability, and this we all know, I mean, it becomes self-evident, doesn't it, but always good probably to remember, a life lived in a sense of compassion for the others, to think of another person before lashing out, or to think of oneself before arming oneself with some kind of inappropriate activity, is a great source of peace. And one of the things I think often monastics reflect upon is that monastic life has very little memory in it. Like, that's why Venerable Nyanico's trip was so interesting, because there are all these exciting things and he had these great stories. But most of, you know, do you remember the meditation in morning meditation 4 days ago? You know, what's to remember? Same old chanting. And that might sound rather boring and but actually, the experience itself of meditation is very peaceful, but it doesn't leave a lot of memory traces. it doesn't leave a lot of stuff going on. So the mind which abides in moral purity and the open-heartedness of generosity has a kind of natural stability, has a natural stability of a mind freed from a lot of heavy memories, a lot of heavy remorse. And that's a foundation for peace, isn't it? A lot of self-respect. A lot of self-respect, which is really nice. I think of myself, you know, some of the strongest memories I have was like when I was had longer hair and doing crazy things, and that was like 45 years ago, or whatever. So long ago, and yet those memory traces are very, very strong. So when we practice these good practices, we're putting our consciousness in the stream of goodness, aren't we? You know, we're aligning our lives with goodness, with the forces of goodness, because compassion is a force, isn't it? Generosity is a kind of energy, isn't it? And so when we live in these good ways, the opportunities for that which is destructive, those energies of destruction and remorse and cruelty and so on, they don't have a chance, they don't have the strength to manifest, because we've now aligned ourselves with goodness. And so the opportunities for goodness have a chance to arise. So these are things that we'll always be reminded in a Buddhist practice. And they're simple enough, and I think they're self-evident. But they are very beautiful. They're very, very beautiful. Simple enough. And then in the gradual teaching, the Buddha would the texts tell us the Buddha would speak of divine rebirth, you know, the possibility of other modes of consciousness. And so you could take that metaphorically, or you could take it literally. But for me, it points to when we read about those kind of divine possibilities, that it points to the fact that we as human beings have that kind of divine quality in our hearts, if we are willing to go there and develop that. And the ideas around compassion and contemplating a lot mudita. Mudita is if you're familiar with the Brahma-Vihara teaching, mudita is the connection to beauty. Whether it's a beauty in a person, or beauty in a piece of art, or beauty in a natural setting, beautiful beauty in the color of a blue jay's feathers, and we have this capacity to appreciate beauty. We have difficulty of trying to accumulate beauty, difficulty of greed, but we also have another capacity which is very uplifting. The capacity to put away our complicated thinking minds and observe life, observe others, to have the empathy for someone's success and beauty, to have the empathy for to have the connection to these fabulous flowers. You know, they are beautiful, aren't they? But I'm working on flower arrangement in our monastery. I'm going to take some of these pictures here. But when we kind of let the minds be quiet, we look, and we're receptive to those flowers, that's a very uplifting quality. That's how I look at mudita, which is a kind of divine possibility in the human heart. And I think these are very, very important, because the heart qualities of goodwill and compassion and the upliftment of beauty are ways of I think human fullness, because Buddhism can be a very, very intellectual endeavor. I mean, the analysis that we have is very, very interesting for me, but these heart qualities aren't something you so much think about, it's something you begin to do and remember and cultivate and notice in one's life, and they bring a very uplifting quality to the practice. Divine quality. Most difficult is, of course, a peaceful coexistence with the way things are, upekkha. This is very difficult. But when we can see that, also it's a very profound possibility in the human heart. You start to combine all these, and these define these, like generosity, morality, the opening of the heart, these define our what we call our social reality, we could say. That we live as social beings, we live in societies and cultures and families and all the rest at monasteries, and that we are connected. And this way of living in society with goodness is a very important part of the teaching. And so this we would call like social truth or social reality. And in that way of speaking about the teaching, that's where we employ the sense of self. When we think about, I am Viradhammo, and I have my responsibilities, and I have a plane ticket to go back to Canada, and I have to take cholesterol pills, and da 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 da. That's me in the world, as an individual, and that's one kind of truth the Buddha talked about. And then he sort of switches, doesn't he? He says, well, but there's another way of looking at truth. There's another way of looking at our existence, and that's more, you could say, the stream of consciousness way of looking at life. And both are true. Both are true. A stream of consciousness way of looking at life is now a kind of inner attentiveness to moment-by-moment awareness on changing nature of being conscious in a sense body, having mental faculties, having physical faculties, and beginning to observe that as a stream of events. And there we try to disengage the use of the sense of I and try to engage a different set of perceptions. And so this would be, we'd call liberating reality or liberating kind of way of looking at life. And there we rather than employ the, like for instance, rather than employ like I'm fed up with a deer fly, or I'm really hungry this morning, or I wish I hadn't said that, or God, that was a great coffee we had at Starbucks just now, or something like that. We employ a different kind of a perception. And that's perception in which we call this-that conditionality. And this-that conditionality is a very simple structural principle in nature. And it basically saying with this being, that comes to be, with the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not come to be, with the cessation of this, that ceases. So if I took this fan thing, and I went something like that. There you go. This being that comes to be, yeah? With the ceasing of this, that ceases. Now I gotta figure out how to cease it. What do I press to cease it?
Off.
Okay. There you go. So that's a structural principle, isn't it? That exists all through nature. I may never get these off, but it was hot anyway. So then rather than think in the ways of self, the teachings ask us to employ a different kind of a perception. With this as condition, that arises, this being that comes to be, with this not being that does not come to be, with the cessation of this that ceases. And that is a perception that the teachings are asking us to employ. It's not a belief. You can leave it as a belief, but it's a way of perceiving. We perceive things. We perceive the glass, say, the classic one. The glass is half empty or the glass is half full, optimist, pessimist, take which one you want. So we interpret life. Perception is very, very important. This is big, this is small, this is hot, this is cold. Perception builds up our world. If we didn't have perceptions, we'd have Alzheimer's of some sort, or perceptions that were skewed, crazy. So perceptions are very, very important. But this particular way of perceiving things, this that conditionality, is a way where we get out of the egotistical way of interpreting life and start to see, well, really, how does this stream of consciousness work? How does it really work without any assumptions? And you can see that with deer fly as condition, this being, that comes to be, aversion comes to be. And that's true. Yeah, I could say, I'm angry at the deer fly, or you could say, this being, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. And then I go into the sala, and they're not there. This not being, that does not come to be. A sit down, there's no aversion. There's no annoyance. With the ceasing of this, that ceases. And that is true too. And what happens if you actually employ that kind of a perception? And you have to employ it, you know, you have to make the effort to actually perceive things in this particular way. And this is hard. This is hard to do because our conditioned viewpoint, our conditioned perception, is that I am someone who's angry or I am someone who has a history. And conventionally speaking, we're not denying that. But this particular way of perceiving is a way which requires tremendous mindfulness. You have to be very mindful, very attentive. And what happens if you do that? What is it you actually employ that kind of perception? Well, if you start to do that, what it does, it begins to undermine the sense of a self-reality. It begins to undermine that. You begin to sense a kind of a peacefulness in the heart, which we would say is empty of self. Not empty of content, not empty of presence, but just empty of that the sort of taint of self, or the smell of self, or the coloring of self. So let's say let's take something like memory. So maybe yesterday I said something inappropriate to one of the bhikkhus. I was in a bad mood, and I used some really cruel language, maybe, and then today the memory comes up. Maybe my nature is kind of self-disparaging, so I'm sitting meditating, and then the memory comes up, and I yelled at this monk. I didn't do it, honest, but I said something unskillful to a monk. So this being, what comes to be? What comes to be is a sense of self. Oh gosh, I blew it again. There I go, I did it again, I'm not mindful. Now, if I take the self-perception, what happens? I get reborn into a kind of a world of self-disparagement. There's that monk, there's my personal history, there's time, there's that event, there's the memory. I have to change, I'm a terrible person, I shouldn't speak like that, etc., etc. And that we call self-view, sakkayaditti, it arises in mind. That's suffering. The other, well, he deserved it, is also self-view. So maybe I'm not a self-disparaging person, maybe I'm a really domineering kind of chap. And I think, well, he was a junior monk, it doesn't matter really. And didn't like him anyway. That's still self-view, isn't it? But if I look at it differently, and this takes a very attentive mind, I see with that memory as condition, there is this sense of self arising. What I begin to see is that sense of self is an object. I'm not that subject. And it arises conditioned on that. This being, that comes to be. And then the memory ceases, and that sense of self ceases. And maybe the memory pops up again. This being, that comes to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. And I begin to see that this movement of mind is something that is natural, quite natural, but that there is something more profound than that kind of self-view that I have. And again, you have to employ this perception. You have to kind of do, Buddhism is a kind of do it thing, isn't it? You have to do that. So what happens, so you have to kind of like see that operating. And so look in your own heart, say, what are the very strong self-perceptions which persist in your mind? And are they perceptions which bring you happiness? Do they bring release? Do they bring freedom from suffering? Or do they kind of persist in the mind in kind of habitual patterns of self and other, me and so on? And see if you can notice how they arise. That they're not permanent entities, are they? They are configurations in consciousness. You can't deny that. But you begin to see that they are empty of any substance. But they do exist. This being that comes to be. So the sense of self does exist in that way. But you see, you begin to see it as being really more vacant, more transparent, not really something to be believed in, something that moves through consciousness. So then the application of that kind of a perception begins to break down the whole sense of self in time. And these are the more kind of liberating movements of consciousness where, you know, they're not involved in time. They're always involved in the timeless sense of presence. And as we apply that principle, then we come across the teachings on dependent origination, which are given in various ways in the text, but the kind of probably most, one of the most relevant ones is the capacity to stay attentive at contact. So we talk about in this that conditionality, we say that that we as sense beings, we have sense consciousness, and our senses are constantly being in contact with life, with sights and sounds and so on. And that the difficulty of contact and our sense life is that sense contact has pleasant and unpleasant consequences. And because we are, when we are enthralled by sense contact, when we are enthralled by sense experience, we think that's all there is, and the pleasure and pain that we get from that, we have to maximize the pleasure, minimize the pain. If that's all we have, then of course we are forever on a treadmill. And so when the pleasant comes up, what arises is a certain sense of self, and we attach to that, and a certain kind of world of pleasure arises. And then when the unpleasant arises, then a certain kind of sense of self gets engaged with that, we attach to that. And so there is this kind of restlessness of constant being caught up with contact, feeling, attachment, sense of self. And this is how we define the world in this transcendent sense, not the world as my social responsibilities and me as a monastic, have a monastery in Canada, so on, but the world is something that is continually moving, constantly arising, ceasing. And that's not just a theory that you can notice. You can really notice that if you begin to pick up this, that conditionality as a perception. And so the teaching asking us is to, you know, it's a very high standard of awareness now. Can you stay with contact? Can you stay with contact? Or does contact then take you to pleasant feeling or unpleasant feeling? Do you get reborn into it and get attached to it? And this is hard to do, hard to stay there. Hard not to get reborn into the sense of self, hard not to proliferate, hard not to make problems. And so our training in mindfulness is that very challenging teaching to remain with contact. And we all do this quite practically. If you're, you know, when you're meditating, or even now, let's say you're meditating, you're used to meditating half an hour and you come to the monastery, maybe it's a 45-minute sit, and, you know, like maybe 25 minutes, your hip starts to hurt, right? That's contact. And the contact was always there. You were sitting on the cushion, but all of a sudden contact becomes strong. Why? Because it's unpleasant. It's painful. Painful. And if you really use that little piece with this, that conditionality, you begin to see with the unpleasant as condition, a sense of self arises, a sense of time arises, psychological self arises, and you begin to think about, when is the sitting going to end? Should I move? Has the Ajahn fallen asleep? Is he going to ring the bell? I forgot to ring the bell. I didn't set the clock right a few mornings ago in the monastery. And went for an hour and a half or so, and why is everyone so restless this morning? See, we have a lot of power. We have the button. But you know, just that little exercise is actually very edifying. Very edifying. If you allow yourself just to see, okay, here this is definitely unpleasant. some compression in the back or whatever. And just notice, if you stay with contact, no sense of self arises. And it's very hard to stay with contact. Why? Because craving arises with the unpleasant. I want to move. I want to get out of that. You could willfully say, I'm not going to move. I'm just going to sit through right through the hour. But that's still self-view. I am someone who has to sit through the hour. Or you could move, which is fine. There's no law against that. But before you moved, you know, if you say, oh, with unpleasant this condition, begin to see how the sense of self arises. And you go back to contact. And you see, oh, it's empty of self. And then the self arises. You go back to contact. You start to be just with contact, just with contact. And that is a very interesting exercise. And again, it is edifying because it indicates you that conditionality. That's how it works. That's how it works. And you begin to see the profit of staying with contact. And then all the like teachings like patience, bearing with, enduring, begin to make a lot of sense. Because they're not coming from a kind of egotistical willfulness, they're coming from discernment and wisdom. And I think all of us who, you know, are developing meditation, we've all, like when we started meditation, like maybe you could sit for 5 minutes, right? Most of us, our knees are up here or something like that, and it seemed impossible. It seemed impossible to meditate. And then you get the hang of it, don't you? You start to feel discomfort. You don't go there. Oh, it's just that way. It's just discomfort. You don't create. You don't attach to the craving. You don't create a sense of self. And any lessons like that that we have, any insightful lessons like that begin to play out in consciousness, because those lessons are always bringing us to right understanding and right view. It's not something, and it's not like we're just believing in this, because if you believe in something, that's simply still at a kind of belief level. But if you've actually experienced it physically, viscerally, seen it operate, it changes your view, to right view. And then that understanding or that insight then begins to play out in more complex situations where the sense of self is very strong, maybe some strong disappointment or some very hopeful thing or whatever it might be, very powerful. And you say, oh, well, this is a condition that arises, something very unpleasant or something very, very pleasant. And begin to say, oh, it's just unpleasant, feels this way, pleasant feels that way, staying with contact. And you can see this is a very rigorous practice. One needs a lot of inner vigilance and a lifestyle too. So this is what I think many, obviously lay people are really frustrated by the complexity of modern society and the difficulty of sustaining like a really kind of refined sense of presence. It's not easy. And then from that kind of consideration, then you enter into, well, at least what I find quite interesting, I suppose is the word. Yeah, just I'm really interested in the mind and Dhamma, not in a kind of obsessive way, but how does it work? And so some of the suttas that I've been going over, this Vassa for myself, I've been going back to a teacher which influenced me a lot in his writings, Venerable Jnanananda Thera, who's a Sri Lankan bhikkhu now, he's very, very old, and he wrote a couple of books, Concept and Reality and Magic of the Mind. And I kind of went back to those, this Vassa, and they can seem very abstruse, but when you start to kind of live in the present moment with contact and that sense of self, you begin to see that cease and you begin to abide more in emptiness, then these kinds of teachings begin to be, begin to kind of, well, I think all of us look at them, but the one that this particular book, Magic of the Mind, talks about the Kalakarama Sutta, and in that, the one of the phrases that the Buddha says, he says, in the Tathagata does not conceive of a visible thing apart from vision. He does not conceive of an audible thing apart from hearing. He does not conceive of a sensed thing apart from sensing. He does not conceive of a cognized thing apart from cognition. And this is quite difficult, but it's what it's pointing to is very, it's pointing to the kind of subject-object duality which we believe in like I am a subject and you are the object, so I'm sitting here and you're there, which conventionally is true, right? I have to get up and go out. I have to transport this body. And not denying that conventional truth, this teaching is asking us, okay, can you now take your mind to a refined sensitivity of presence? Can you do that? And in that presence, can you just be with the data? Just be with the data, just with the scene. And so it also takes, so many of us have read the Sutta de Bahia, and Bahia, you should train thus. In the scene, there should be just the scene. In the heard, there should be just the heard. In the sense, there should be just the sense. In the cognized, there should be just the cognized. And when Bahia, in the scene, there's just the scene. In the heard, there's just the heard. In the sense, there's just the sense. In the cognized, there's just the cognized. Then Bahia, you will not be in that. And when you will not be in that, then there will be no here, nor there, nor in between. And then, you know, when you first read that, you say, what are they on about? I'm just going back to samadhi, or I'm going to make some toothwoods. But, you know, I think for all of us who do this work quite seriously, to take this kind of sensitivity of attention now, and just be with the scene. And the scene is just the scene. That's something you have to do again, just like that conditionality is a perception that the text suggests we do. You have to do that and then see what's the result. If you believe in it or whatever, you never try it, well, then you never know. But you have to do it. So what's the result when you do that? What's the result when you just stay with contact? Well, I find my mind was empty of self. So if you do that and just like you just look at something and the scene is just the scene. So I just look at Lompo Cha. And before I conceive of anything, any picture, it was just that, just suchness. What happens is the mind goes very quiet and the sense of self falls away. And you have to hold that. You have to hold that for a while. Think about thinking. When you're meditating, sitting there and you start to think about, go seeing, maybe, so you have a job interview next week or something, and you're sitting there and you find the mind's thinking about a job interview. Now, in the cognized, it's just the cognized. The Tathagata does not conceive of someone who is cognizing outside of cognition. And if you really look carefully at consciousness, you'll see that when thought arises, you perceive that, I'm thinking. I'm thinking too much again. That's the perception you have. But that's just a perception. Self-perception. But if you're just very attentive, just thought is just thought, the sense of a thinker's not there. There is thought. Thinker's not there. And you don't get into the bind of being the person, I have to stop thinking. I have to get my practice together. There's too much thought. The sense of self arises again. In the cognized, there's just the cognized, and you will not be here, there, nor in between. And this is the way I for those of us who look at the fetters, for me, this is the way I contemplate asmimana or mana or conceit in the sixth or seventh fetter? Or the subject-object duality that we experience in the world, a sense of me separate from that. And to actually take that teaching and then just begin to, like, look at a flower. In the scene, there's just the scene. Do not conceive of a thing, a visible thing outside of the scene. And so I suggest, you know, if you've been in the practice for a while, try these things. Like try that kind of exercise where you're not trying to get anything out of your meditation, but you're just with the data before all the assumptions, before the assumptions of self and the world and all of that, and to be with the sense data. You don't have to close your eyes, you don't have to do anything special practice, but just be in the presence of hearing. So do hearing, say. The Tathagata does not conceive of an audible thing outside of hearing. Then you just listen, just listening. And before you conceive of a world out there of sounds and you hear, before you do that, what happens? The mind goes very, very silent, it goes empty. Natsutta goes on, I do not conceive of an unseen, I do not conceive of a thing worth seeing, I do not conceive of a seer apart from the seen. And holding attention in this way is actually very, very interesting. Like if your spiritual life is one of always trying to purify the bad guys in your mind, gosh, that's tiring, isn't it? It just goes on and on. I have so many bad guys. But when I, you know, then I'm all, you know, if I go that route, that I'm, I've got all these kilesas, I still have to do this, and that, and I've got to do these practices, God, give me a break, right? Give me some coffee. But if I just notice like some murderous impulse towards a deer fly, where this is conditioned, that arises, this being that, and just so this is just a murderous condition. It's just that way. In the cognized, it's just the cognized. The whole sense of me having to do something, me being a person in a separate kind of world, that falls away, and the world arises and ceases. The world arises and ceases. The world arises and ceases. And this has very beautiful results, very beautiful results, but it's very hard to do, to sustain a mind which isn't constantly conceiving and creating and doing. And yet we have to conceive. We have to perceive. We have to live our lives. Tana John's building this amazing building here. There's a lot of thought goes into that. So it's not that we become some kind of, you know, without thoughtless beings. We use thought, but there's this other part of our lives. This the spiritual part, the entry into something which is transcendent. Transcendent, which is not self kind of referencing all the time. If our practice remains just at a psychological level, just trying to always get my psychological states right. I mean, it's a good thing to do, isn't it? But if it's always like self-referencing, I need to do more of this and less of that and so on, the sense of self is very, very strong. And to look at that, to see. With this as condition that arises, this being that comes to union. And you begin to see all the kind of self images that come up, like all your committee members in your brain, right, that come up into consciousness. They're just these beings that come and go, this, that conditionality. And you begin to just hold your mind on the seen, on the heard, on the cognized. You hold your mind with that. And these, sometimes we call this sunyata bhumi, the realms of emptiness. And emptiness has a very positive connotation in Buddhism. Empty of self-referencing, peaceful. So when the conceit of self comes up, either in comparison, let's say I've suffered a lot from self-disparagement, so if I, maybe I'm taking, this is not the case, but maybe I'm an anagarika, maybe, and I'm cooking in the kitchen, and I, you know, it's almost 11 o'clock, and I get a big bowl of spaghetti or something, and I drop it on the floor. Bang! Splash. First thought is, oh, you idiot. You idiot. And if you take this, that condition in, you know, this being that comes to be, with your arising, that arising. And you see the sense of self. Self-disparagement is just an object. It's not who you are. You're not an idiot. You're not very clever either. but the abbot will tell you that. and you begin to see that's not a reality. It's not who you really are. You know, that's just conditions. And so the world is no longer your dwelling place. It's not your abiding. Your abiding becomes in emptiness, in a sense of peacefulness with the changing nature of the world. You do your best. Next time, you know, you make sure you grab the spaghetti bowl better or whatever. But you do your best. So look at that. Again, I suggest really look at like any sense of self that comes up, comparison with others, history, personal history, I was this and then I'll be that and so on. Look at that as like just cognition, just this way, very, 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 very direct. This is just sense data. It has arisen, stays for all, goes away. And then that kind of attachment to pleasure and pain, that begins to fall away. Because you find there is something in your heart which is transcendent of pleasure and pain, something which is more profound than pleasure and pain, sense consciousness. You can enjoy pleasure, you have to endure pain, that's all right. Enjoy a good cup of coffee or the spaghetti or whatever. But obviously there are higher possibilities, deeper possibilities. And then you have a good balance. You know, you have a good balance of the spiritual heart, which is empty of self. Self-view, self-attachment, conceits, which abides in that kind of peacefulness. And then the social life that we live, living in generosity, living in a way which is morally beautiful. And so these two truths, we Lompa Cha would often talk about these two kind of truths. You know, we have the social reality, the social conventions, not to dismiss them, they're very important. And then this other way of looking at stream of consciousness. So I hope that wasn't too complex, but that's what I've been contemplating this vasa. So just to kind of to close, I'd wish you all very best in the worldly dhammas. I wish you success and prosperity and good health. And in the transcendent dhammas, I wish you the deepest, deepest contentment. Ewang. Sadhu.